Two Boca Raton men were recently arrested for running one of the largest Medicare fraud schemes in the U.S. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Federal authorities busted more than two dozen people, two of them in South Florida, for defrauding Medicare of more than $1 billion. We'll learn about how the scheme worked and why South Florida is fraught with fraud schemes. Also, staying in Boca, we'll talk with author T. Kira Madden. Her book, Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls, is the April title for the Sundial Book Club. She'll share what it was like growing up in what she lovingly called the rat's mouth. And finally, the Boca Raton Museum of Art launched a new exhibit all about comic book and graphic novel art. But this is not an exhibit where you're going to find Spider-Man or Superman. It explores the world of fine art within comics and graphic novels, also while tackling questions about race and gender. All of that today on Sundial. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, last week, the Justice Department announced a sweeping investigation that charged 24 people in a $1.2 billion Medicare fraud scam. Prosecutors call it the biggest healthcare fraud scheme in the country's history. Two of the 24 people charged included Elliot Lowenstern and Cregan Harry, both from Boca Raton. The men are accused of duping Medicare patients into buying medical equipment that they didn't need. Lowenstern has a long history with shady business in South Florida, including ties to Jordan Belfort, the famous penny stock trader depicted in the film Wolf of Wall Street. Jane Musgrave of the Palm Beach Post has been following the story, and we spoke to her this morning. We started by diving a little deeper into the how of how this scheme worked. Now, a note, we reached out to the Justice Department and Office of Inspector General to join us for the conversation and provide more details on the investigation. They were unable to join us today, but the invitation remains open for the future. This is an extremely complicated fraud scheme that involved a lot of people. From your understanding, how did the scheme work? How did Lowenstern and Harry dupe both Medicare patients and their doctors?
It is a very complicated scheme. I mean, what the Justice Department has said is that it involved people across the country, involving more than $1.2 billion of losses. It also involved a separate case involving another $1.7 billion in claims that resulted in another $900 million in losses. And apparently it targeted Medicare Part B. And that is the part of Medicare that pays for medical equipment. And I'm sorry to go up in the weeds here, but part of it is companies called DMEs, Durable Medical Equipment Companies. And they apparently, according to the Justice Department, they paid bribes to telemedicine companies such as Dr. Lowenstern and Mr. Harry operated.
Let's talk a little bit about who, you know, Mr. Lowenstern and Mr. Harry are, their backgrounds. They have fascinating backgrounds.
Yes. Mr. Lowenstern apparently was a childhood friend with Jordan Belfort, who everybody knows from The Wolf of Wall Street. They, according to Belfort's book, they were childhood friends growing up in Queens. They launched their careers as, you know, teenagers, selling Italian ice to beachgoers, made a bundle. According to Belfort, they were pulling down like $400 a day and, you know, made $20,000 to, you know, help fund their college educations. You know, later when Belfort started his investment house in Long Island, it appears that Mr. Lowenstern was also involved in that. You know, they called themselves Strattonites.
Yeah.
After the name of his firm, Stratton Oakmont.
Yeah. And then how about Cregan Harry? What about his background?
You know, I don't know quite as much about Harry's. I know that he has, like Mr. Lowenstern, they both have backgrounds with the Federal Trade Commission. Mr. Harry was accused in a civil action of running a scheme where he would send like massive spam emails out to people touting his herbal medicines. It was back in 2005. He was ordered to pay $485,000 to the Trade Commission for using spam messages to make bogus claims about his herbal supplement business. And he was also barred from making those claims in the future.
What can you tell us about this company these two were working for or with, the Video Doctor Network? What was that?
Well, that was, as I understand it, that was like kind of the whole fraud revolved around telemedicine companies throughout the country. And both Mr. Lowenstern and Mr. Harry are accused of operating some telemedicine companies. And, you know, how those work, I guess the federal government, you know, okayed them, you know, thinking that this was a way to bring healthcare to rural communities. So, you know, because recognizing healthcare wasn't available to people, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, they could talk to doctors on the phone. And so that's where they gained access to, you know, predominantly elderly and disabled people, all their, you know, their personal information. And then they ordered braces, like wrist braces, knee braces, back braces for these people, whether they needed them or not. And that was really the crux of the fraud. And so they billed Medicare for millions of dollars worth of, you know, either medically unnecessary braces or braces that, you know, never were delivered to the patients.
As you said, this scheme reached over $1 billion, and you, there was a couple dozen people involved. Were the two men operating within a bigger network?
It appears so, but it is not clear. I mean, because there were so many people and the breadth, you know, extended from California to New Jersey, the inference is that, yes, that it was part of a bigger network. But, you know, they are charged in a separate indictment, charging them with $200 million worth of fraud.
I'm talking with Jane Musgrave, staff writer for the Palm Beach Post. Last week, two Boca Raton men were charged in a nationwide Medicare fraud operation worth more than $1.2 billion. We have more on that story, by the way, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So, Jane, Harry and Lowenstern, no strangers to the law, as you said. What were some of the other previous crimes that we know of?
Well, Mr. Lowenstern got wrapped up with Jordan Belfort and in the penny stock scandal. Mr. Lowenstern was accused of operating a company, an investment house in Fort Lauderdale back in the early 2000s. The prosecutors accused him of like buying stocks from Belfort's company and then selling them at inflated prices to his customers in Biltmore Securities, which was based in Fort Lauderdale. He pleaded guilty but was placed on probation. Mr. Lowenstern, in addition to Mr. Harry, he was also, there was a lawsuit that a Federal Trade Commission filed against Mr. Lowenstern back in 2004, and he was accused of running a software company in Delray where they would use software to trick customers into thinking that there were problems with their computers, and then they were referred to like salespeople that would use high pressure and deceptive tactics, according to the FTC, to get the customers to pay for unnecessary repairs and or long-term maintenance programs. So that was, and he was also fined, along with others, $236,000.
Did the Justice Department give you any details about this investigation or how they broke it up?
Not the specifics of it, just that it was a massive investigation. I mean, it involved, you know, 17 federal districts across the country. It involved U.S. attorney's offices in South Carolina, New Jersey, and the Middle District of Florida. You know, it involved, you know, the Medicare fraud strike force. I mean, it was clearly a massive, massive investigation.
Yeah, the Office of Inspector General, along with the Justice Department, they've developed a Medicare, as you just said, a Medicare fraud strike force in South Florida. And it's one of the key regions in the country. Do we know why Medicare fraud remains so rampant a problem in this region?
You know, I think fraud in general is a, you know, rampant problem in South Florida. You know, it just seems like not a day passes that we don't hear of yet another fraud scheme. And yes, I think a lot of it is, you know, involves Medicare and other health insurance fraud.
Do we know how common this type of Medicare fraud scheme is here? I mean, this was the biggest or one of the biggest, right?
Yeah, this seems, you know, just because it targeted medical equipment, it seems like an unusual scheme. You know, this isn't something you would think that would be lucrative to fraudsters. You know, braces for the elderly, and they managed to figure out a way to, you know, scam the system.
And they scammed it for hundreds of millions of dollars. What are the next steps in the criminal trials for Harry and Lowenstern?
Mr. Lowenstern has been placed on house arrest at his home in Boca. And Mr. Harry did not, he agreed to go back to New Jersey. They both were indicted in New Jersey And so Mr. Harry has been taken, or will be taken, to New Jersey, and Lowenstern will eventually go there as well to, you know, to fight the charges.
And you think about all these, because they used people to be able to, you know, commit this scam. But were there victims? I mean, did any of these folks, did they get hurt in any way?
I don't get the idea that they did. But I could be wrong about that. Okay. You know, I just think that their personal information was used in ways that, you know, it shouldn't have been used. So from that standpoint, yes, there was a harm.
Jane Musgrave, again, staff writer for the Palm Beach Post. Last week, two Boca Raton men charged in a nationwide Medicare fraud operation, again, worth more than $1.2 billion. You can read more of her story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Jane, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, still to come on Sundial, we're going to go back to the 1990s. And we go back to Boca Raton, a new memoir from a local writer about growing up there. Our conversation with the author of April's Sundial Book Club title, T. Kira Madden, is next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, this month, the Sundial Book Club has been reading Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls by T. Kira Madden. The debut memoir chronicles Madden's childhood in Boca Raton. T. Kira shares her experiences as a queer and biracial woman. She opens up, as she calls it, a Russian doll of memories from traumatic experiences like sexual assault, substance abuse, and grief. But also in the midst of that, beautiful recollections of womanhood, friendship, and fun times at middle school dances. The book is structured as fragments or flashes of her memory chronologically, and it ends with some shocking revelations that T. Kira found out while writing the memoir. We talked to her while she was on book tour last week. You can join our book club, by the way, on Facebook. Just look up Sundial Book Club.
I was traditionally a fiction writer. I studied fiction in school, got a graduate degree in fiction, and taught and wrote fiction always. And I never had any interest in nonfiction until my father passed away. And I ended up going to an artist residency. And instead of working on my novel, I found that I really couldn't find my focus in my fiction, that suddenly all these questions about my father and my life kind of started sneaking into the story. But I never intended to kind of make a catalog of traumas. I just kind of began where those questions began, which was in death. The first piece I wrote of the book was about his death, which was tied into the mannequin. So the first memories I had of him and the last memories I had of him, and how kind of the body of the mannequin echoed back to his body as it kind of left him in the hospital. Once I opened one memory, I kind of began opening other memories. I keep using the term Russian dolled, but I think the book really Russian dolled on me. Once I opened one, there was another box and another and another.
People write memoirs at different stages of life, but I think a lot of times we tend to think of like, well, I'm going to wait till I've lived some life before I think about it. But why did you want to, you know, when you finally started putting all these pieces together and that mm-hmm. Russian doll, as you say, started to open up for you, why did you decide, you know what, now is the time to do it?
There was always a condescension of, you know, you, what do you know? You haven't lived your life yet. Go out and live your life before you write any nonfiction. And I think that kind of scared me off of nonfiction and memoir until I wrote this book. But I think that's a really false idea. I think that can be a gendered idea, it can be an ageist idea. And I think the more I've read memoir and nonfiction, the more I realize it's so not about the sprawl of life, or at least it doesn't have to be, as much as it has to be about an experience, which is sometimes a single experience that's rendered beautifully and vastly. The idea that it has to be about an entire lifetime to be worthy of one's time is a false one.
The title, Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls. My understanding is that that wasn't your idea, right?
It wasn't, no.
So what happened? How did this come about?
I loved the title, The Rat's Mouth, for Boca Raton, as I'm sure your listeners will know. I liked the kind of punchy irony of it. I liked the translation. And I just thought it was really neat that the translation for this city that is so beautiful and so wealthy and has such a kind of polished reputation had this dark underside and this translation of The Rat's Mouth. but my editors felt that title kind of closed down instead of opening into more questions. It felt like a punchline to them. And also, I think they didn't want it to veer so dark, which was really interesting to me because I think through writing it in different stages, I had different ideas of what the tone was. And of course, in the beginning of writing it, after my father passed away, everything was dark, everything was difficult, and that was the book. And through editing and revising and working through it for years, I actually found some levity and some humor, and I hope that comes across in the book as well. I liked in the end their choice to choose something that felt a little more triumphant, and I think it worked. A lot of people have found this book through that title because they feel part of that tribe, whatever that tribe means to them.
It's always fascinating when you read a memoir as to where a person will start their story, because you could start anywhere. You start with the first chapter, Uncle Nuke. And you write mm-hmm. about this mannequin that your mother rescued from a JCPenney dumpster and places it in the window in the apartment that the two of you were living in at the time. What is the significance mm-hmm. of starting the book with the mannequin?
That was actually the first piece of the book I wrote. And miraculously, it stayed as the opening. And I think there's something really special about that, that, you know, this book came to me through this memory of the mannequin just after my father died. And that still remained kind of the opening note of the whole thing. I knew I had this question of whatever happened to the mannequin. And I like the idea of different stand-ins we have for fathers, mothers, parents, whatever it may be, that often we have this, an object or another person or these substitutes. And it's also just an explosive way to introduce my parents, that my mom is the type of person still who would, you know, rescue a dummy from a dumpster, and she still has mannequin heads she uses to take the HOV lane in New York City.
That is such a Florida thing, by the way.
Yeah, completely.
I wanted to know a little bit about that relationship you had with your father growing up and how it changed. And by the way, your father, too, is brother of well-known shoe designer Steve Madden, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that relationship with your father.
I think of my father as this larger-than-life figure, the love of my life. I loved and love my father still so much. And I think that relationship and that presence can be in flux in someone's life. And I think perhaps people or listeners who have addicts in their life can relate to that idea that you can live such a different life with someone while they're actively using versus when they're in recovery. And that was certainly the case with my parents. It's kind of like a lazy one or the other for people to say, like, this is a book about fatherlessness, or this is a book about father love or mother love and mother loss. Like, those things can coexist. And I think that's true for most of us, that we have moments where we feel that absence and moments where we feel that deep love. I think that's true for most relationships in our lives. So I don't think of myself as fatherless as much as I think of the fatherless tribe of people who are always kind of wrestling within that question of what that means, or people in and out, or people off and on, but always the movement towards a deeper understanding of a person.
People who have spent any time here in South Florida know that you mentioned Boca Raton, and like any city community in South Florida, each community has its own personality, and people will think of Boca Raton and they have ideas that pop into their mind. How do you describe growing up in Boca? And as you mentioned in the book, as the only Jewish, Hawaiian, and Chinese girl at your school, but how do you describe that childhood in Boca Raton, in the school you went to, in the community you lived in, and the friends you had?
Usually my kind of opening punchline, because I've lived in New York since I've been 17 years old, people say, Boca Raton, I know it. And I say, let me guess, your grandparents live there. And they say, yes, I come home every winter to visit. So I think there is like that kind of direct flight between Long Island and Boca sometimes. So I actually do still feel this kind of deep connection to Boca because of that, because so many people I meet in New York State, Long Island, New York City, have a relationship to Delray, Palm Beach, Boca, and they do have this understanding of it that I think in other parts of the country, maybe they do not. But I describe it as bizarre, polished, luscious, sparkling, dark. I think most of us might describe the place we're from in really conflicting terms. And I think bokeh is that, but two extremes. And I think that's what makes it difficult to explain. I did the best I could in this book, but I could write the same book 10 years from now or 10 years ago, and it would probably look different.
I'm speaking with T. Kira Madden, author of the memoir Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls. The book is our April title for the Sundial Book Club. T. Kira grew up in Boca Raton, Florida. Her debut memoir chronicles her childhood, the highs and the lows. And you can join the book club, by the way, on Facebook. Just look up Sundial Book Club. We'd love to have you, and we'd love to hear what you think of the book as you're reading it. You know, as I mentioned, your parents struggled with substance abuse, and at least for me, the more touching part of this story was that of your mother's battles and how, you know, that impacted your relationship. But, as you were telling these stories or preparing yourself to tell these stories, did you have a strategy on how you wanted to tackle this?
My mother is the exception in that she's the one person I asked for permissions of what I could write about. And I can say, you know, I was very lucky in that she never once told me to take anything out.
I mean, as she's reading it, how did she feel about, what did she tell you about seeing her life through your eyes?
So it was really a very new and interesting process for both of us. I knew up front that she was the person I cared most about. She's obviously alive. She's in recovery. And it meant so much for me to honor her experience in a way that never felt embarrassing, humiliating, coming from a place of malice. But I think she knows me and trusts me and my work enough that I did talk to her before I wrote a single word. And then I gave her essays as I wrote them to go through them. And I think it's certainly bizarre, but I think ultimately the reason she didn't want me taking things out is she said to me in the very beginning, she felt that she doesn't have necessarily the platform or vocabulary or skill set to render her experience as an addict, but she felt that I could. She felt that by me kind of using her experience in a way that she felt I could do justice to that experience, I could kind of offer a beating heart and a pulse behind this kind of caricature of addict parent, which is just like a bad parent who's absent, who's passed out, whatever the caricature may be that we're used to on television or movies. I think she was hopeful that I would be able to show the humanity behind what that looks like.
One of the fascinating aspects of this book is that throughout, you actually take a moment to tell us about where some of these people ended up. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, has anybody else from your past read this book and responded to you?
Mostly with a great deal of support. I'm sure there are people who have read it and who might not be happy with me, but I haven't heard from them yet. You know, I think it's important in some cases that people read the full book and therefore the full context. I think it says something about the fact that I am willing to be very honest about myself on the page. It was important for me not to write myself as, you know, a hero going through the hero's journey with no flaws and just kind of casting judgment on other people. It was important for me not to cast judgment on people or make conclusions about people, but to just have the experience there for the reader to make their own conclusions or judgments.
You talk about the hero's journey. Fascinating aspect of this journey that you take is during the process of writing it, you discover that you have a sister.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
I'm still trying to find the vocabulary, I think. I did my best in that book, but I'm still processing. I mean, the events of the last third of the book are very new in my life. I was writing them in real time after I had sold my book, and I was writing it as it was happening. It's still one of the more strange and beautiful and miraculous things that's happened to me in my life. In this age of, you know, Ancestry.com and 23andMe, I think these stories are becoming more and more frequent and talked about. And, you know, every time I bring up Ancestry.com and my sister, somebody else knows somebody who found out about their sister, their brother, their dad wasn't their dad, this affair, that affair. So it's kind of a really interesting time right now with these DNA tests, and these secrets are just being blown open. And sometimes I feel kind of bad about that as much as I'm so grateful. This is the greatest gift of my life. Often I'm like, wow, is it really right that we are kind of blasting open these secrets that were buried so long ago in our families?
You are on book tour right now. What are you hearing from readers as you travel around the country? What are they telling you about their experiences reading your book?
I think with memoir and nonfiction, what you get is really personal reactions and people sharing their own stories with me in a way that wouldn't necessarily happen with fiction. I wrote this book to communicate with people, to open up a dialogue about issues that are important to me. And in some cases, issues people don't necessarily feel comfortable sharing or talking about. I wanted to take things like sexual assault, drug addiction, privilege, race, and I wanted to shine a light on those things because those are things that have been hushed in my own history and family. And I think in most people's cases, those are things that are kind of shrouded in shame or darkness. They don't want to talk about them. At these events and readings and through my inbox, I'm just seeing people say, you know, this happened to me, and they want to talk about it, or they just want to feel that in some cases they don't want to talk about it, but they just want to, you know, shake my hand or give me a hug and say thank you for putting that out there. I feel less alone in this experience now. Certainly my experience growing up, I didn't feel I had the literature I wanted, and therefore I felt like no one else in the world could possibly understand what my life was like, when that's not true. I mean, these things are so common. It's just that people don't write about it or talk about it as much.
As I was reading it, I started thinking to myself, if I were to write a memoir, you know, I'd have to spend some time trying to remember things, you know, accurately. Mm-hmm. And for me, I mean, at that stage of life that I'm in, if I were to look back on my childhood, there are flashes of moments, but it's like, wow, to try to remember details, a lot of details. For you, what was that like? Was that mm-hmm. difficult?
Well, first of all, I like the way you use the term flashes, because I think that is how it feels. Sometimes I get questions about the structure or the fragmentation of my book. And it was very intentional, because memories do come in kind of those flashes or those moments, those really distilled kind of flashes of sensation or dialogue, whatever it is. And I wanted to mimic and mirror that experience in the book, and that's why it is fragmented. I wanted to say something about memory, but I can speak for me personally. I do have almost a supernatural sense of memory. I think growing up, I was often in kind of a flight or fight mode of panic and hyper awareness, and I think that definitely contributes to my memory growing up. I remember things from when I was, you know, 5 years old more than I remember last week in certain cases. And I also kept journals and diaries. I accessed those a lot while I was writing this. So those were the tools, plus a great deal of interviews and conversations that I used to kind of render my life in this way.
Tikira, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Such an honor. Thank you so much.
That is Tikira Madden, author of the memoir Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls. That's the Sundial Book Club title for the month of April. And we'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on the book so far. If you've been reading it, you can join our book club on Facebook. Again, just look up Sundial Book Club. We'd love to have you. Well, still to come, we're going to dive into the debate about comic book art. Is it really art? I think it is. There's a new exhibit at the Boca Raton Museum of Art that challenges your view of comic art. It's all coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, there's a debate in the art world. There always is, about comic book art. And is the art within graphic novels and comic books, is it really art? Depends on where you stand on the issue. Well, the Boca Raton Museum of Art is hosting an exhibit. It started today And it talks about, you know, this idea of comic book art and graphic novel art that both comic book lovers and those who are unfamiliar with the medium can both appreciate. It's called Beyond the Cape, Comics and Contemporary Art. Again, starts today, runs through October 6th, and it explores the world of graphic novels and comic books in a way that it highlights a lot of the difficult themes that these stories cover, a lot of themes. Well, joining me now in studio, Kathleen Goncharov, the curator of the exhibit and senior curator at the museum. Kathleen, great to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us, one of the artists who you'll be able to see their work on display during this exhibit, Michael Zansky. Michael, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
You know what? Start real quickly, Kathleen, the show, Beyond the Cape, Comics and Contemporary Art. Not your typical comic book and graphic novel art, by the way. And I can see a lot of, you know, Supermans and Thors and all that. But how would you describe it to somebody who may not be familiar with the artists that you've got on display?
Okay, because for the most part in the gallery are artists who are influenced by comics, not comic artists. But there are many comics artists in our reading room, because in a museum people stand to look at art, and in they don't like to stand while they're reading the comics. So right. I made a reading room where you can actually sit and very comfortably read some of the newest, hippest graphic novels and comics, including a lot of manga. And but in the gallery itself is art, as I say, artists who are influenced. And the first thing you see when you come in is Michael, a huge, huge graphic foot coming out of the ceiling. It's very dramatic, and it's supposed to be like 20 feet tall. Very dramatic. And then in the next room, Chitra Ganesh, it's a giant hand, 12 feet by 8 feet, and it's a projection from the ceiling, so this hand blinks on and off, a kind of pattern you would see that women in the Middle East and Asia, Southeast Asia, henna their hands for special occasions like bridal showers and weddings and things. So it's that, but it's a very bright flashing video projection. So that kind of introduces you to the kind of drama of the show.
Where did the idea for this exhibit come from? How did it start?
Well, you know, there's so many, I mean, the superheroes are everywhere. And a number of museums have done shows about superheroes. So I didn't want to do that. We wanted to, like, stay away from that. So it's called Beyond the Cape. And so I've avoided mostly the superhero thing. I have one another video that's an animation called Not a Superhero, in which the artist has created this kind of anti-hero who kind of tries to fly.
You purposely wanted to get away from
yes.
that idea of the typical superhero,
yes.
the mythology of the superhero.
Yes, because it's everywhere. So
yeah.
we don't need to see that again.
And of course, you know, I mean, this is that time of the year when the movies that are coming out are all, you know, we just have Hellboy came out, and mm-hmm. of course the Avengers is coming out with their movie.
Of course, of course. So it's, so enough of that.
Yes.
I mean, I do have one Jamaican-American artist who created her own superhero persona
yeah.
who fights racism, but she doesn't have a cape. So it's, and that's,
And it's interesting, as you point out, because you talked about some of the first pieces that you'll see when you walk in. They are very big.
Yes.
Michael's pieces are also
are
just
monumental.
Very big. But you have all kinds of pieces. And
yes.
you have pieces that are your I guess, traditional art on the wall.
Yes.
But you have multimedia pieces as well.
Oh, yeah. We have a number of animations, videos about Renee. There's actually a television program that was done for Italian TV about her and her superhero, her character named Raje, who, you know, fights racism and sexism. So yeah, there's a lot of different things. There's some rare comics in the case.
I want to talk about this
yeah,
one
yeah.
in particular. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, and
real quickly, turning to Michael, I want to ask you about Michael. How were you approached to do this? What did you know? Who was the first person that came to you? And what did you think about it?
For the show,
yeah.
it was Kathy. Kathy had seen the work and thought that there would be a very interesting fit to what's going on in contemporary comic art at the fine art end of things, where it's not a particular kind of storyboard that has a fixed narrative yeah. in a way.
Now your career spans so many years and so many styles, so many different types of art that you've created on different mediums. These pieces, as she described, very big pieces. I believe they're on wood.
That's correct.
Why that surface? Why? What is it specifically you enjoy working on that?
Well, it harks back to something that was done millennia ago with Egyptian art, and in the case and Assyrian art in the case of stone. I find I was looking for something that was a low relief, getting away from oil paint particularly, and going for both color carving and burning with the wood. It has deep historical connotations for me. And also the structure of my work itself runs into the many pieces. So it is a serial form of a kind of comic strip, an ancient comic, in my case, an ancient comic strip, because I'm fascinated by all of the cultural things that cross over into the idea of telling a story. And I find the precursors for it going back to cave painting, Egyptian art, hieroglyphs, Mesoamerican art, where a story is enacted and told. It's just told and differently.
But you're right, almost like comic books today, in a panel form, in rows, that you follow the story.
It's a hieroglyphic form.
Yeah.
It's a form that has dominated all art across all platforms culturally to tell a story. So what we're looking at now is our cultural moment in some way to express that, both in a two-dimensional and a cinematic form.
I wanted to ask you about one of your pieces, Foot.
Right.
As Kathleen was describing it, this large piece, the best way, I'm not going to do it any justice, but basically an image of a large foot, and it is it standing on, stepping on, pressing on? And I'm going to let you tell me what it is, because I'm not, I don't want to do it injustice.
Well, it's an octagonal form. That's the wood is deeply carved. So what it is it's an octagonal shape, and what it's standing on looks like a kind of geological map, and it's pressing down on it. But its base goes back to the time of the Romans, actually, and Constantine. There are fragments of a very large sculpture by the Romans of Constantine that's now in tatters. And I thought to myself, it was something about the foot and the balancing act of it on this octagonal form that had meaning for me. And so I pursued it.
Coming back to this conversation that you had with Kathleen about this exhibit, I wanted to get the sense from you again of, she's describing how they wanted to approach this idea of comic art, graphic novel art, really more of the artists who were inspired by it. But then listening to you, it's again, and looking at your background, interest in so many different eras of art, I guess as you're pointing out that, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that it's really just one form of communication. We've just taken it to the next level today.
Correct.
It's still the same thing.
Correct. I mean, my analysis of cyclical paintings in Italian Renaissance art, if one looks at the chapel by Giotto or the Sistine Chapel by Michelangelo, it's a storyboard. It's really a storyboard of the history of the Old Testament and then finally the New Testament.
Remind me too, by the way, because just going back to my art history classes, from the Renaissance period, they were the furniture panels that had stories on them on the outside. You'd open up, there's more story inside. Mm-hmm. You know which ones I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. It's more still a continuum. That's what we're doing today still.
Yeah,
it's still
stories. Yeah, people love stories. And we're hoping that people will come to the museum and read stories and see stories.
A lot of different stories, a lot of different art. By the way, you brought some things in that I wanted to ask you about, too, a couple of the things that are going to be on display. Again, we're talking about a new exhibit at the Boca Raton Museum of Art. It's called Beyond the Cape, Comics and Contemporary Art. It's not just for fans of comic books. It goes beyond your typical comic book genres and mythology. It really is fascinating. But if you're a fan, you still will enjoy it. We're talking with Kathleen Goncharoff, the curator of the exhibit, and also one of the artists who's got works on display there, Michael Zansky. And you could see, again, some of this work for yourself on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Kathleen, you talked about there's a reading room. You have, obviously, all the works on display, but there is a place people can go to enjoy a little bit of reading, a little bit of relaxation.
Yes, so because these are so narrative graphic novels, they go on for pages and pages and pages. Even though it's great art, it really is meant to be in book form where you sit and read it. So in a museum, it's very hard to show that. So hence, we came up with the reading room. And so we have hundreds and hundreds of titles. And, you know, talking historically, for instance, you know, we have our Crumb comic of Genesis from the Bible. We have Sandro Burke's The Divine Comedy. We have actually an Egyptian comic in there about ancient Egypt, and, you know, pharaohs and the stories of that. So, and then it's, you know, really contemporary topics as well. Or even, again, historical. One of my favorite of the comic artists is Ron Wimberly, and he wrote The Prince of Cats, which was, you know, won awards. Anyway, it's basically part of Romeo and Juliet, but set in a black neighborhood in Brooklyn. With gangs, and they fight with samurai swords. So it's kind of a hip-hop mashup of Elizabethan English and street slang. And it's absolutely brilliant. So you can see that in the reading room.
Yeah, and I just tweeted out a picture of the cover so people could see that. The other thing, too, is this, is that you brought in Calvin Reed.
Yes.
To help you with this. Why?
Well, he's
with the exhibit.
Yeah, he's an old friend of mine. He knows everything there is about what's new in graphic novels. He's a senior editor at Publishers Weekly, has a podcast, and his beat is comics and graphic novels. So he sees all of them as they come out. So he recommended comics for me to buy for the reading room, because I wouldn't know. I mean, I know the art world, but not that world.
Right.
And he really does. I mean, he's one of the people who really put graphic novels on the map as art, as an art form.
Is this show really more for adults?
Yes, very much so.
Okay. No, because, I mean, you talk about Crumb, for example.
Yeah, that's very much adult.
His work, very much. Absolutely. You know, Michael, I wanted to know from you, you grew up with a father who was also an artist, but also he was well known as an illustrator, as an artist in the golden age of comic books, Louis Zansky. And I wondered what it was like growing up with him and that influence on you?
There was no way of getting around it. I mean, my earliest memory of him was standing at a drafting table and drawing out frame by frame the sequence of, at that time, he was working on horror comics, but before that he was working on Classics Illustrated. And I was like, you know, stunned about just how clearly he was able to get to the message within the lines of those frames, those sequential frames. And so it had an enormous impact on me, and had an impact on me later on in my film work. I've done a lot of film work, and most film work that one goes to see is storyboarded. They lay out sequence after sequence of every frame that goes on in a movie, so that that they know what the camera angles are going to be. They know what the shot making is going to be. They're designing the mythology. They're actually going through the art directors and the draftspeople are going through the sequence that follows the storyline in a very succinct way.
Did your father ever give you advice on art? I know you've talked to art students giving them advice, but what advice did he give you?
He was very generous in directing me away from that. But then something got screwed up along the way, and I ended up later on getting involved in work that initially I thought was rather thin, not seeing the full complexity and historicism of it. So it really was something. It was, a kind of a childhood rebellion that I regret now. So, you know.
Well, that's what most kids do. That's what we rebel against our parents. But, how often do you, because, you know, and he also, beyond just the comic book art that he was working on, had worked on a lot of different types of art, but how much of him is in you?
Oh, probably a lot of the good stuff, and I try to get rid of all the miserable stuff.
And I won't dig any more into that. How about that? You know what? I wanted to just come back and touch, because I started this whole conversation with this question of is this really art? And I remember from my art classes the constant debates, whether it was with professors or other students, like, you know, what is art? And I always enjoy reading a good comic book or reading graphic novels, especially those that were not mainstream, and saying, how could this not be art? But I mean, it's how often do you hear that debate, Michael? And, what's your take on it? Art is art, or is it something else?
Well, nowadays, I think it's got tremendous, not just now, but I think that... in the case of pop artists like Roy Lichtenstein or even early Warhol and many others, they followed that form. They thought it was a very popular and compelling form for the viewer to follow. And I think it's carried forward. And if you want to stretch it a little further back, you have Picasso, who was a great admirer of the Sunday funnies. He loved that stuff. So... the history of it is very, very interesting in relationship to the fine artists that would then take it and run with something else. Because comic strip basically is a, you know, in miniature of fine art. You've got fine artists that take it and elevate it in painted terms to a larger, a quote, ethereal nature as far as where it can be, where the crossover can come from, carrying it past the comic form into the fine art form.
Kathleen, I wanted your take on that, you know, because as a curator, you think about the when you're putting a show together, all the different themes that you're looking for, the different art you're looking for, you're putting something like this together. You see it as art? It is art.
Oh, of course it is. Yes, I do. It's just, as I say, if it's something you need to sit and read, it doesn't go well on a museum wall, where what we have things are big, spectacular things that will make an impact when you see the show. So that's why I divided the show into the two sections, the things on the wall, which are, you know, very bright and colorful, and but not lengthy narratives. There'd be brief narratives, but the lengthy narratives, you know, the 400-page graphic novel, is in the reading room, where you can take an hour to just sit there and look at it.
Right. All right. So besides Michael's work, if I were to say, I know it's not a fair question since you put this together, but I'm curious, if I said to you, I got a couple of minutes, tell me which ones I need to go see right now.
Okay.
Do you have favorites?
Peter Saul is so important. He is in his 80s, late 80s, I believe, and associated with the California funk movement. And they're very bright, very colorful, very political, and very funny. They're very cartoon-oriented, but they're not long narratives, and they're big works. So I think he's, like, so important. So, you know, the artists in the show range in their 30s, and they're emerging artists, and then they're a very, very famous artist. So I really wanted to make that mix. So, yeah, Peter Saul's important. Trenton Doyle Hancock is a very interesting artist who is very much influenced by cartoons and graphic novels, and he's got a whole fictional universe he's created with these characters. And Ballet Austin in Austin, Texas, commissioned him to write and do all the visuals for a ballet. So we're showing a big projection of that. So you've got to see it. It's light color is brought back into the world from a black and white world in this video.
And just to remember, it is really more of an adult show.
Oh,
just,
much more.
Just so you know. Again, it's the new exhibit at the Boca Raton Museum of Art is called Beyond the Cape, Comics and Contemporary Art. Again, not just for fans of comic books. It really goes beyond that. Really something fascinating. We've got some of the images that we've posted up on our social media, WLRN Sundial, so that you could check it out for yourself. It runs through October 6th, right?
Yes.
So it's up there for some time. No excuses. Again, we spoke with Kathleen Goncharov, the curator of the exhibit, the senior curator at the museum. Also, one of the artists on display there, Michael Zansky. Michael, Kathleen, thank you so much. It was
such a pleasure.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great show. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, April 16th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandro Martinez. Our intern is Kaylee Rodriguez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. And our technical supervisor, Peter J. Merritt. Our theme music from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. You can find them online, gopalo.com. All right, there's no show tomorrow because of the school board, but coming up on Thursday on Sundial, a deep dive into the Wynwood neighborhood, a look into the plan to transform a number of the streets so that they're more pedestrian and bicycle friendly. And the Wynwood stories take the audience along a journey of the neighborhood's past, present, and future. All of that coming up on Thursday. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. Thanks for listening. Talk to you again on Thursday.